We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning. Morning.
By the way, they used that minute to insert the chip.
Okay. That's, man, I wonder what that was. It was felt like a pretty sharp bite. Okay.
Okay.
No one else knows what
we're talking about.
Nobody has a clue.
And, okay, we're going to keep it that way.
We could sell premiums of the CDs of the conversations before and after the microphone.
Yeah, we'll try that next week. All right, let's tons to cover, starting with minimum wage.
Yeah, this week a minimum wage poll conducted by EMC Research of local Seattle voters found that Seattle voters support raising the minimum wage to $15 per hour by a whopping 68% to just a very small 25% against. Now that's well over a two-thirds majority.
And that comes with some conditions. Oh, wait. No, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't. No. And in fact, 79% of respondents agree that, quote, increasing the minimum wage is the right thing to do, end quote, which is kind of interesting. That's four out of five people who agree that overall morally increasing the minimum wage is the thing to do. It makes me kind of wonder what the other one out of five are thinking. But as Jav said, there were no qualifiers to this. When the questioners asked voters, you know, do you think letting employers count tips or other types of payment as a credit to the minimum wage is okay? A lot fewer people said that that was okay, or, you know, exempting nonprofits or only requiring large companies to pay $15 per hour. No, most people said that they supported straight up $15 per hour.
And doing it immediately. No phase-ins, no five-year gradual increases. Just do it right now, you know, for everyone. And the idea being that, that's going to create some hardship for some organizations and for some small businesses, but it's also going to be such a boost to the local economy in terms of people having spendable money in their pockets that it's going to more than outweigh that.
Yeah. And I think, too, people understand that when you say, you know, the minimum wage is $7, $7.50 an hour, federally, they just look at you and they go, my dog couldn't live on that. You know, $7.50 an hour. That's just outrageous. So when you say $15 an hour, most people are like, yes, why not?
And a couple other things from the tabs in that, just very briefly. The strength of the support is also very good news for proponents. 35% of voters strongly support the proposal. Only 14% strongly oppose it. And support goes through just about every subcategory that was polled, with the exception of Republicans, which obviously is not a very large group in the city of Seattle. So very, very interesting and important news for the mayor and the city council as they debate what exactly they're going to pass this year for $15 an hour, and very good news for 15 Now and the other proponents of a minimum wage initiative, that if the city council doesn't do something with no strings attached, they can put something on the ballot for November that will pass with that immediate impact.
All right, moving on. Appears Bertha's not going anywhere anytime soon.
Yeah, the big drilling machine that is drilling the tunnel under downtown for the near the waterfront for the downtown traffic tunnel is still stuck in the mud and apparently not going anywhere anytime soon. There are leaks in the seals that protect the main bearing in the cutter head. Seattle Tunnel Partners are trying to determine if the bearing itself is going to need to be replaced, and if so, that could take a long time. As it is, even without replacing the main bearing, it's going to take months for them just to repair the seals. WashDOT says, that's the Washington State Department of Transportation, they say that Seattle Tunnel Partners will cover any of the cost overruns and not Seattle taxpayers, according to the contract that was negotiated with Seattle Tunnel Partners. But, of course, both sides, I'm sure, are already lawyering up and looking at the contract for ways to figure out who's going to cover the cost overruns for Bertha sitting idle for months. Bertha has only completed about one-tenth of the 1.7-mile tunnel. And of course, the state has a risk reserve fund, but it's only about $200 million for this project, which was initially
a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, which was initially forecast to cost a little over $3 billion. Other people said closer to $7 or $8 billion. My guess is it's going to be closer to the $7 or $8 billion.
I'm going to go on record now and say 10.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of people who were opposed to that project to begin with were warning about the unproven technology. Warning about the likelihood of cost overruns, and maybe we just need a little sound effect every week for the next 6 years that says, I told you so.
Yeah.
And we'll just skip on from there. People might be a little tired of it, but, you know, we told you so.
And in the meantime, Seattle Tunnel Partners has hired a PR firm, Tim Seiss's firm, Seiss Bain East Strategic, to burnish their public image while Bertha sits idle.
Funny thing how the right-hand man of Greg Nichols, who annoyed so many people during his tenure here, seems it's like the Joel Horn of our decade. He seems to have his...
He pops up everywhere.
He seems to have his claws attached to just about every money-making project that benefits from local government large east these days.
So the heads on Bertha might not be spinning, but there's still spin coming out of the project. That's good.
Yeah, and they're still digging a hole. Yep.
All right. Well, I was surprised to hear the news this week coming out of Jay Inslee's office.
Yeah, Jay Inslee and a lot of people were, including death penalty proponents, because this is something that had been urged on state government for many years and not happened. It's been over a decade since Illinois became the first of the modern wave of states to declare a moratorium on the death penalty, and Washington State became the latest this week. Jay Inslee announcing that so long as he is governor, he will not sign any execution orders for current inmates. He will commute for death row inmates. He will commute their sentences, but only for the length of time that he is governor. So and did so with the stated goal of spurring conversation, basically, on the death penalty. Now, why Washington State still has the death penalty at all when so many states do not, and when Washington State uses it so rarely, and it is so hugely expensive, far more expensive than life in prison because of all the mandatory appeals processes that you have to go through in order to verify it. And for the last, I think it's 20 years now, there have been either zero or one, I didn't get a chance to look it up exactly, inmates who've been executed who had not waived all their executions and you know, decided that waived all their appeals because they wanted to be executed. So, you know, at this point, the law functionally is state-assisted suicide, but very, very, very expensive. We're talking to the tune of millions of dollars for each person state-assisted suicide. So very good news, but it is still incumbent on ordinary activists and voters to convince the state legislature or launch an initiative that would permanently repeal the death penalty in Washington State.
Yeah. The law is still on the books, really, and it's only the moratorium only lasts while the reprieve for these death row inmates only lasts while Inslee is governor, and who knows what the next governor will do.
All right. Moving on, developments this week with the Republican caucus in Olympia.
Yeah, and I happened to be down in Olympia yesterday and on other business, some bills I'm involved with, and I got some interesting scuttlebutt also. But the Republican caucus and lawmakers announcing this week that they are still negotiating with themselves. I wish I were making this up, but I'm not, on a revised statewide transportation package in the Senate that they can try and reconcile with the one that has been passed and passed and passed in the Democratic-controlled House. The Senate, as you recall, for last year and again so far this year, has failed to pass any kind of transportation package. That's why we're facing budget cuts for Metro. That's why, as we've talked about, the Columbia River Crossing project between Portland and Vancouver, Washington, appears dead, and all sorts of necessary maintenance and bridge and road infrastructure projects in Washington State have gone wanting as well. Rodney Tom, the majority leader in name only, is talking about, you know, the last 2 weeks they've said they're going to release this thing, but it's still in process. But as we saw also this week, there's been a lot of fallout on the Tea Party end the Republican caucus with a passage of the Dream Act, which we talked about last week, that because there were a handful of Republican legislators who voted in favor of it, there's been an open revolt of sorts within the Tea Party wing of the Senate Republican caucus. We've had four Republican lawmakers now, including Pam Roach locally and Don Benton, who's very very prominent in the Republican Party from Southwest Washington, who have pulled their names from the Republican caucus list on the party's website and have been threatening to withdraw from the caucus entirely. And basically the whole idea behind this is that Tom has lost control of that caucus that is now being run by the Tea Party, and we're seeing that level of obstruction exactly similar to what we're seeing in the federal Congress from our state legislature as well. And one lawmaker told me plain, basically, it's a direct quote, that Tom has lost control to the Tea Party crazies. And that's how it's being viewed in Olympia. And so in terms of how the budget is going to turn out this year, in terms of anything else worthwhile being passed, that's the filter it's got to go through.
Yeah. I mean, usually this year, you and I are talking a lot about the different bills that are making their way through the legislature, and there's just nothing that I can see that is being passed by the House that is going to make its way through the Senate because of the Republican infighting.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
Let's go.
All right. And then some developments this week as to who and who isn't running in 2016.
Yeah. Patty Murray announced that she's going to run for re-election again in 2016. This will be her fifth six-year term. If she is elected in 2016, by the time she is up again in 2022, she will have been in the Senate for 30 years, have an enormous amount of seniority, and
be difficult to unseat.
Well, very difficult to unseat because she's going to raise a truckload of money this year.
Yeah.
On the other hand, somebody who's not running is Doc Hastings, our old Republican friend from the 4th Congressional District in Eastern Washington, who really first got national notoriety.
You mean that ironically?
Yes, I do. as a matter of fact, first got a lot of national notoriety during the Bush era as head of the House Ethics Committee, who literally refused to take any action at all against even the most egregious aspects of the Tom DeLay and Jack Abramoff scandals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He has been a really, truly dreadful congressional member from Eastern Washington, and he will be retiring in a district whose composition is changing because the Latino voter registration is you know, growing steadily larger in that part of the state, and so it'll be very interesting to see whether the state Democratic Party can muster itself to find a viable challenger for that open seat, because potentially a well-funded challenger could do well in that district, but only if the state Democrats feel like it's worth their while to make the effort.
All right. On the national and the clean debt ceiling bill?
Yeah, the House and the Senate, the National House and the Senate, passed a clean bill finally to raise the debt ceiling and send it to Obama without any amendments, which is kind of against what John Boehner had initially said he wanted to do. He was the one who initially came up with the idea that the House would never pass a bill to raise the debt ceiling without attaching another amendment to it that would make cuts somewhere in government in order to fund any increase in borrowing in order to pay off their earlier loans. Now, of course, the far right immediately eviscerated him and other members of other moderate Republicans in the House who joined the Republican leadership to vote for this bill.
Of which there were not very many. All the Democrats voted in favor, and then a couple dozen of the Republicans.
Yeah, and among those, it was mostly members of the Republican leadership, a few retiring congressmen, and some moderates who apparently must think that their districts are safe because, you know, this is a midterm election year, and these far right groups are going to come out and attack those Republicans.
Yeah. And you know, the Republican leadership in the House has been arguing in favor behind the scenes of passing these debt ceiling things and not having these confrontational strategies all along, and getting nowhere with the Tea Party types who, as a matter of principle, refuse to compromise on anything. What finally became a winning argument that they convinced enough folks to stand down, or at least stand apart from the Tea Partiers, that they could get this passed, was a very simple argument, which is is that with the way districts have been drawn by Republican-controlled state legislatures, it has been so gerrymandered that it would take an overwhelming Democratic wave to win back control of the House at any point before redistricting happens again in 2020. And so in all likelihood, the Republican majority in the House is safe. And this year, because of the wave election in 2008, way more Democrats than Republicans are up for re-election. And there is a very strong chance that Republicans could get control of the Senate after 2014 if the Republicans do not alienate the public by, for example, forcing another government shutdown. And so the idea behind this wasn't that they want to walk away from this tactic or that they've realized that it's counterproductive or harms the economy, etc. It's that they want to win control of the entire Congress after this coming November. And they figured by lying low right now, hopefully the public will forget just how radical and crazy they are. They can win control of the Congress and then make government even that much more dysfunctional starting the beginning of next year. That was the strategy behind this. And it's not a bad strategy from their standpoint. And certainly the way it has been portrayed by media feeds right into that, and even phrases like moderate Republican, because there really is no such thing as a moderate Republican anymore.
So they're trying to appeal, in other words, to districts that might swing Democratic, where there could be a swing either way.
What they're trying to do is stem their losses by, you know, right now they've been losing voters every time they have one of these confrontations because people are just repelled by their tactics. And what they're trying to do is say, no, we're not really like that anymore. We're not controlled by those folks, when in fact they still are.
They still are. And, you know, some members of the Republican leadership ditched Boehner and they said, we're not voting for this. Like Kathy McMorris Rogers here from Washington State, she's the fourth ranking Republican in the House. She didn't vote for
it. I thought she never left the kitchen.
Yeah. Right. And then Paul Ryan too, the so-called Tea Party superstar on budgetary issues, whose math is so fuzzy it's basically non-existent. He also ditched the Republican leadership and didn't vote for it.
2 + 2 = 106 is not fuzzy math. It's bad math.
It's just, like I said, his math is so fuzzy, you can't even really call it math at all.
All right. Moving on, the governor of Maine setting the bar?
Yeah, setting the bar in terms of Tea Party crazy for how crazy and how sociopathic can you get. And granted, this could be a weekly feature of somebody who's set a new standard. This would be a bill in Maine that Governor Paul LePage has come out and opposed and threatened to veto that would increase access to a drug called naloxone, I believe is the name of it, naloxone, and there's a trade name for it too. But what this is a drug that can reverse the respiratory failure that happens when you have overdoses of opioids. So, for example, heroin overdoses of OxyContin and other kind of painkillers that people are addicted to. What happens when people overdose on that is it paralyzes your respiratory system, mm-hmm. and you can't breathe and you suffocate to death. And for first responders, for paramedics, police officers, etc., if they get there in time, that can stop that. That can save those lives. And so there's a bill in the Maine legislature that wants to put that drug in the hands of paramedics, EMT teams, police officers, etc. It's a very simple thing that would save a lot of lives. And it's being opposed because this is according to the sponsor, and this is direct. LePage's main objection is his belief, and I have to emphasize his belief because there is zero evidence that supports this at all. His belief that increasing the availability of Narcan or naloxone will lead the drug user or drug abuser to have a feeling of invincibility. In other words, you know, if he thinks we won't, he's not as likely to die from it, he'll go ahead and take it, and therefore we want him to die from it. So number one, this is going to directly kill people. It's going to directly kill a lot of people because the number of heroin overdoses, and this is true in Washington State and King County, as it is true around the country, has really spiked in the last couple of years. It's become a serious, serious problem again. And, you know, we've already heard a lot over the past few years about the increase in in painkiller addictions, and one is directly tied to the other. People start and being by getting addicted to painkillers, then they realize that heroin is a lot cheaper for, you know, and it's basically the same addiction, chemically speaking. And so they go to that. This is the same sort of logic, basically, as seatbelts should be illegal because otherwise you'd immediately drive your car straight into a tree. I mean, it's just
it's crazy.
It's seriously, seriously crazy and sociopathic because it is literally going to prevent the people that we pay to save lives from being able to save those lives. And doing so because the people whose lives they would be saving are deemed by somebody like LePage to be expendable.
Yeah.
All right. Fuel study out this week.
Yeah, there was a study published Friday in the journal Science that looked at natural gas fuel versus diesel fuel for trucks and buses and asked the question, which one is truly cleaner? Now, there's been a big shift, particularly in places that have a large bus fleets or truck fleets, away from diesel fuel with the assumption that diesel fuel is very dirty towards natural gas fuel. And of course, we've seen it here in the city of Seattle with the Metro buses shifting away from diesel fuel towards using natural gas and other types of alternative fuels. And what the study found is that, in fact, diesel is cleaner regarding global warming. Because even though diesel puts particulate matter into the air, drilling for natural gas produces methane. And methane leaks, which are very common in oil and natural gas drilling, methane is 30 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. The study was done by Stanford University and MIT scientists, so it's a very credible study. Also, they came up, one of the results of their study is that there's already 50% more methane in the atmosphere than the EPA estimates is actually there. And they put that down to the recent boom in natural gas drilling. They also are calling for the EPA to regulate methane leaks and that it should require oil and natural gas producers, as well as those companies that transport it and store it, to install equipment to capture methane leaks, and that there should also be an inspection program of whether these companies are actually following the regulations. Of course, some companies probably already do it because methane has a value and can be sold, but many, if not most, don't, because of course that's an extra expense, and most of them are out to cash in on the natural gas boom while they can.
And Obamacare.
Let's skip that and go to international.
Okay, let's the NSA. And developments this week with a new website that just went out.
Yeah, Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scale launched a new website this week. And their first story was a big one. It was a source, not Edward Snowden, but his material is consistent with this, saying that the NSA has been using electronic surveillance and metadata in the location of cell phone targets that the targets are believed to be using for their drone targeting, rather than human intelligence. So that is to say, you know, using the location of a cell phone and using, say, known patterns on the internet to guess at where a person might be, and then launching bombs. Now, there's a couple of obvious problems with this. Number one, you have no idea who's actually using that phone. And in fact, terror groups, according to this source, have been taking advantage of this by swapping phones regularly to try and confuse it and try and make sure that the highest value targets, they are even more likely to reach somebody else because they're only using a phone once or twice and then passing it on to somebody else. And of course,
a lot of terrorist groups have cottoned on to the fact that you don't use cell phones anymore because they're just too risky.
Yeah, or you swap out the cards, you know, literally every few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And the other piece of this, of course, is you have no idea who else is there. So that it is a policy that by its very definition treats collateral damage as not a consideration whatsoever, which is precisely the opposite of the insurances that the Obama administration has incessantly been making, really since the day that Barack Obama was first sworn into office, that, well, this target is very precise and we do everything possible to make sure that there are no civilian casualties. Well, this is exactly the opposite of that. This is saying we launched the drone strikes and we have no idea who else is in the area. We don't care who's hurt by this. There's no precision to this whatsoever. whatsoever, and we don't care about collateral damage as long as we kill somebody that we think might be the bad guy, but in fact we actually have no evidence that it's the bad guy rather than the village kid that was handed this phone by this guy in the passing truck a half hour ago. So we killed the kid instead. We have no idea if it's even the right target or if there's 20 other kids who are hanging out nearby, or guess what, it was given as a stocking stuffer to that wedding party. I mean, it really is breathtaking in the level of sociopathic behavior that we're not only executing people halfway around the world, but we don't even have any idea who we're executing or whether, in fact, they have anything to do with what we're allegedly trying to stop.
All right. Developments with Iran?
Yeah, this week Iran agreed to discuss its nuclear weapons the allegations of its nuclear weapons program with UN inspectors. And on Sunday, they agreed to provide info on explosive detonators and allow additional inspections of known nuclear sites that have been suspected of part of their nuclear weapons program. That includes uranium mines near Yaz, a facility at Ardakan, and a heavy water reactor at Arak. Now, I think that's a really, really another very promising step forward that is not getting a whole lot of attention in the U.S. media.
All right. Very briefly, a poll on Cuba.
Yeah, Atlantic Council poll of more than 2,000 people, which is a very large sample size nationwide, and they included extra sampling among Hispanics and in the state of Florida, found that for the first time since polling has been done on this, a majority, 56%, favoring a more direct U.S. engagement with Cuba or a normalization of relations. People in this country have moved on from the 1950 Cold War mentality that says we have to embargo Cuba. It's time now for politicians to get on that train.
All right. Events.
Oh, a whole lot of them. Today, we talked earlier about the widespread public support for $15 minimum wage. There's a day of organizing for 15now.org, the group that is threatening to put an initiative up, starting at 2:30 with workshops, and then there will be speakers and music, and it goes all the way through the evening at the office of SEIU 775. That is downtown at 215 Columbia Street. Info on the full schedule, since you may not want to spend all 8 hours there, at 15now.org. Tomorrow from 6:30 to 8:30, there will be a presentation on Restorative Justice by Andrea Brennecke. She's the director of Restorative Justice for the City of Seattle. That's being put on by the Western Washington Fellowship of Reconciliation at Woodland Park Presbyterian Church, 225 North 70th Street in Finney Ridge, tomorrow evening. On Tuesday evening from 7:30 to 9:30, we talked last week about the latest tour of war criminals flogging books. This week is libertarian pundits flogging books. Megan McArdle, the very dreadful pundit from The Atlantic, will be in town at Town Hall, $5. But, you know, it's a free market, so come tell her what you think of her opinions. Wednesday night, February 19th, actually afternoon from 12 to 1:30, it's a luncheon thing. Wheel, the homeless women's group, will be having its 21st birthday event. That's actually very impressive. Plymouth Congregational Church is where they will be celebrating, 1217 6th Avenue downtown. Thursday evening, 7 o'clock, there will be a panel on wage theft that will be at the UW campus in Parrington Commons from 7 to 9 o'clock. Also from 7 to 9 on Thursday evening, amend the Constitution and cut corporate abuse. Folks from WAMEND will be having a workshop and discussion on their ballot initiative to urge repeal of Citizens United. That will be at the Common Good Cafe, University Temple United Methodist Church, 43rd and 15th Northeast in Seattle. We have a full week for you. And on Friday, the 21st, at 1 p.m. in the afternoon, 350.org Seattle is going to be having a demonstration around oil trains. This is before a 2 o'clock committee meeting and city council to consider regulations on oil trains passing through Seattle. That demonstration and hearing will be at Seattle City Hall at 600 4th Avenue. And then on Friday evening, February 21st, Colbert, Colbert. Will be on the next mass extinction, talking about the mass extinction that's already underway and caused by humans. That'll be $5 again at Town Hall 8th and Seneca in downtown Seattle. A very full week for everyone. Oh, and there's one more.
Yes, and then for this weekend, if you want to do something fun, it's the first annual Seattle Black Panther Film Festival at the Arc Lodge Cinemas at 4816 Rainier Avenue South. It starts started last night, but it runs through the weekend.
Are they serving breakfast?
No, they're not serving breakfast. It's the it's a film festival, so my guess is it's going to be running in the evenings. You can look for the Arc Lodge Cinema's website and see what the schedule is.
The joke being that it was the Black Panthers but people listening wouldn't. Black Panthers created the breakfast program that
Sorry.
Later was the model for federal.
Inner city kids.
My humor can be obscure. It's true.
Talking
with John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.